That's fine. Thank you very much, Dennis. And it's great to see so many of my fellow Western Australians, I can still say Western Australia, here this evening. I'd like to talk about a number of things. But first of all, can I say how delighted I am to be here at the Buddhist Centre. I've learnt a lot from reading, particularly reading Buddhist literature. I feel very strongly that it informs. I feel very strongly that it sends you on the right path to living a constructive life. And since leaving politics, I have been doing a little bit of political consulting. And perhaps the most interesting political consult that I did was with the Sangha in Canberra. Ajahn Brahm asked me to come along and do a political assessment of Buddhism in Australia. And my conclusion, incidentally, was that Buddhism had a lot to offer, but the image that was held of Buddhism within the established world was that it wasn't taken seriously enough. And because I do think it has very important things to say, and one of them I'm going to talk about later this evening is right speech. As you know, politics transmits itself through speech. The community transmits itself through speech, and the way we speak is very, very important. And that's just one thing, one contribution from the previous incarnation that I had as a politician that I think was very important. I also had great pleasure in meeting with Dennis again. And Dennis is a very strong part of my thinking. When the Jhana Grove Meditation Centre was being opened, and many of you might have been there, it was not long after my first wife had passed away with cancer. And I was feeling a bit down and out and wondering where the world was going to go after 30 years of marriage, to lose your wife like that. And I had a chat to Dennis, and Dennis said something to me that was remarkable. He said, "Jeff," he said, "don't worry," he said, "it'll all come back together again." The next day, I got on the plane to go from Sydney to Jakarta. There was a lady sitting next to me on the plane, and she's now my wife. So I think Dennis, there's definitely something he's got going, you know. What I'd like to do today is something I do with my teaching. And for those of you that are teachers, you might try this idea out. Take a word and throw it out and then talk about the word and or a phrase and make it the basis of your lecture and discussion. Some of my favourite words I've used are sustainability. That's a good one. You can really build on that to talk about all sorts of things. Another one is balance, probably just about close to my favourite word, balance. Compassion, that's a good one. What does it mean? Fairness, very, very important word, and a lot of the work I did as an academic was on what do we mean by this word, fairness. Now, focusing on one word can take you in all sorts of directions, but I came across a very interesting reference. And it related to someone called Sir Harold Bailey. Does anyone in this room know who Sir Harold Bailey was? Sir Harold Bailey was the professor of Sanskrit at Cambridge University. And I think he's just about the most remarkable Western Australian that ever lived. Because at the end of the 19th century and early into the 20th century, his parents brought young Harold, very young man, just 10 or 11, over to Western Australia, and they set up on a farm near Meriden. And the University of Western Australia received a letter one day, just after the First World War, and the letter said, "My name is Harold Bailey and I'd like to study Sanskrit. I've been teaching myself Sanskrit. on a little farm near Meriden. And the university people said, well, we don't teach Sanskrit. So he had to learn Latin and Greek. And he did a degree in Latin and Greek and did his thesis on Euripides and then got a scholarship to Oxford where he studied Sanskrit and went on to become a world-famous scholar, Sir Harold Bailey. He died in the 1990s. I once saw him speak at the University of WA when I was a student in the late 60s. But he was an expert on language. And he was once, there's an anecdote about him that said that he once devoted an entire lecture to a single word. And he responded to this anecdote, said, no, he said, that's right, but not quite right. As to the anecdote, I quote Harold Bailey, I in fact talk for 10.5 hours on the Sanskrit word bravano, but only on the form, not on the meaning. So I promise you I won't speak for 10.5 hours today. But do read up on Sir Harold Bailey. You know, I'm a great believer in universities. I think he's probably the greatest of all Western Australians, taught himself Sanskrit as a young boy. He had the encyclopedias. His parents bought him a book on some different languages. He had a facility for language and a remarkable man. In fact, when you walk up St George's Terrace, they have on one of the footpath slabs, they do recognise his achievement. So what's my word? What's my word for the night? Well, I love the story that Ajahn Brahm has in his book, Opening the Heart, on the three questions. You know the story of the three questions? What is the most important time? Now, because in fact there is no other time. What is the most important? Who is the most important person? The person you are with. And what I like about that is it could be you, because for a lot of the time you're actually on your own. And then there's the third thing. What is the most important thing to do? And that's to care. To care. So that's my phrase for the night, to care. What does that mean? So I'll leave that with you. And now I'd just like to say a couple of things about Buddhism before I come back to caring. Why have I been attracted? Let me share some of my ideas with you on why I'm attracted to Buddhism. The first thing I like is that it puts at the heart of things the personal search for the truth. Two things about that I like. The personal search for truth, it has to be meaningful to the person. As you know, there are lots of things we can believe in, but really they're just attached to us a little bit like the suit I've got on tonight. They're not really going to the heart of your thinking or your being. But you're attached to them somehow or another. You find them, but they're not part of your person. You're not satisfying yourself that's really what you believe or what you think. And the other part, of course, is the search for the truth, which is very important. We shouldn't just rely upon the conventions of our society, the social mores. We've got to think for ourselves and learn about the world. Continually testing the views that we might have. And so I love this idea that life should be a learning experience. I love the idea that you've got to make it meaningful for yourself. And this is all very consistent, of course, with modern science. And I remember having a long conversation on this particular subject with my very good friend who passed away just recently, Lackey Jayasuriya, who's a professor of social work at the University of WA, a very close friend of mine. He introduced my sons to all the Sri Lankan cricketers, which was a wonderful day in their heyday when they were winning all the games. And also he was a great conversationalist on all sorts of matters, but particularly on Buddhism. And he said, really, Buddhism is very consistent with modern science, an empirical approach to search for facts. Didn't have a narrow view of what the facts are, but encourage people to really think through issues for themselves, to be on a personal journey to find the truth, to explore, to examine, to test, not just accept a certain dogma, but to really test it for yourself. This is very important. And particularly in the world today, actually, it's important because there is a view among some circles that really science doesn't matter. It's that your opinions matter, and my opinions are facts. Your opinions are facts, and we've all just got opinions, and there's no reference points. There's no way we can try and work out whether or not one is more important than the other. And, you know, in that sort of world, there's only one way you can resolve conflict, and that's through power or persuasion, not through rationality and reason. And I think I very much like that aspect of what I understand to be a Buddhist approach. The second thing I really like is the practical and pragmatic nature. Look for the solutions, find the solutions. Try and free yourself from the biases that are deeply built in to have a look at a situation for what it is and then try and find a solution to the problem. You find, as I found in politics, a lot of politics people, they sort of feed off the problems. They just feed off it. And it's almost as they're swimming in the problems. But in the end, we have to try and solve some of those problems. And I remember reading one of the texts on the Buddhist religion, and I came across the parable of the arrow, which you probably many of you know the parable of the arrow. It really impressed me. It's quite lengthy, but I'll read it to you because I think there's so much wisdom in this parable. It's a bit like the Christian parable of the Good Samaritan. There's so much in there. I quote, "It's just as if a man were wounded with an arrow, smeared with poison. His friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives would provide him with a surgeon. And the man would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble warrior, a priest, a merchant, or a worker. He might say, I don't have this arrow removed until I know the given man and clan name of the man who wounded me, until I know whether he was tall, medium, or short, until I know whether he was dark, ruddy brown, or golden coloured, until I know his home village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow with which I was wounded was a longbow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring with which I was wounded was fibre, bamboo thread, sinew, hemp, or bark, until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was wild or cultivated, until I know whether the feathers of the shaft with which I was wounded were those of a vulture, a stork, a hawk, a peacock, or another bird, until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was bound with the sinew of an ox, a water buffalo, a langur, or a monkey. He would say, I don't have this arrow removed until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was that of a common arrow, a curved arrow, a barbed, a calf tooth, or an oleander. The man would die, and these things would still remain unknown to him. And as the great Buddhist scholar and activist Thich Nhat Hanh said, life is so short, it must not be spent in endless metaphysical speculation. That doesn't bring us any closer to the truth. This idea, I think, you do it. You find the solution. And it's from that you learn. The great American pragmatist always interested me. I think John Dewey, who was the great American philosopher, was a pragmatist, said, how do we get to the truth? Well, we've got to get the theory and the practice together. You can't just have the theory. You have to have the practice, and you have to see what it tells you. What does it mean to live in a good society? Well, we work at it and we find out things and hopefully learn from them. It's practical. Look for the solution. Two people are at war, look for the solution. And it's a very good habit of thinking. And as you know, a lot of politics doesn't do that. It goes for the fight rather than for the solution. So the third thing that I find First thing, I think, is this idea of the personal search for the truth, the importance of evidence and inquiry. It's got to be, you have to understand it yourself. It's an obligation on you to learn. That it's practical and pragmatic. My third one would be that it reminds us that everything is connected. Everything is connected. The world is an interconnected whole, all the different parts fitting together. Now, there's lots of ways in which we should learn from that. One of them, of course, is that, you know, if one thing is done, there will be consequences. There are always consequences. There's no such thing as something that we do that doesn't have some consequences. The way we speak, for example. And a lot of people talk about the freedom, which is very important, to speak as you feel. I'm not so sure that it's a good idea to just speak as you feel all the time. And the first thing that comes up, I think there needs to be some modification going on there so that you take into account the interests of the person you're speaking to and the broader questions. But there is some people have the view, it doesn't matter what you say or what you do, it's your right, you know, you go off and do it. And all of the responsibility is taken away. But as soon as you understand that the world is an interconnected whole, you do know, well, you should know, I think, that what you say and do will have an impact. It will have an impact. And it's part of the caring that I'll talk about in a minute, that we think about what we do, what are the implications, how is it affecting other people? And so I like that aspect, that we understand the world as an interconnected whole, with all parts connected, and what we say and do has a consequence, or has consequences, in fact. Finally, my fourth point is that it very much focuses on how we should live together and indeed on how we can live together. One of the most important questions that I think we need to ask is, how do you live with difference? And we live in a multicultural society, so we've already got a difference. We live in this multi-religious society, we've already got a difference. We live in a society where, yeah, people have different views on all sorts of subjects. We've already got a difference. And what I find about the aspects of Buddhism, one, I said, it's interested in what the evidence is and looking carefully at science. It's interested in finding practical solutions to things. It accepts that the world is interconnected. If you take all those things and throw them into the mix, it's very good at asking and finding solutions to this question, how do we live together? Because you've got to transcend, in some sense, your own interests to live in a bigger a world where there's different interests. The difference can be race, religion, gender, class, sexuality, nation. Living together is a very, very difficult task. And I find that when I read the literature on religious dialogue, I always found the Buddhists seem to be much better at understanding how you've got to listen, learn, show respect. Sometimes very difficult when you're dealing with extreme people who have extreme views, very, very difficult. But it encourages us to try and find a solution. I remember I gave a talk way back in my early time in politics on the question of living with difference. And I said, well, I'll ask a couple of people. And I knew a very impressive Muslim scholar from up in Malaysia. And I had a friend who was an Anglican minister of the Christian religion. Arjun Brahm wasn't part of my intellectual universe at that point, but I certainly would have asked him as well. But I said, what's the answer? And they both said the same thing, and I was quite impressed. They both said, well, what you've got to do is make sure that people of different religion are working on the same problem together, because they'll learn that we're all the same, really, and we've got to solve this problem, therefore we've got to get on together rather than to divide up. I thought that was quite a good answer to the question of living together. But in the literature, I find the Buddhist tradition is very strong on reconciliation, very strong on listening, very strong on deliberation, very strong on thinking through, not just talking to someone else, but really engaging with them, which are all the good values that we need for a democracy to work properly. And so that's, I suppose I'd say, they're the four reasons why I found Buddhism a very constructive contributor and something that gives great meaning to life. And when I did the talk to the Sangha on the politics of Buddhism in Australia, I really feel these messages should be higher up the order. You know, the established church tends to be asked on a lot of these questions, and I find that they don't have very good answers. Some of them come up with good answers, but generally speaking, when a Buddhist is asked these things, they come up with better answers. And so I think there's a challenge there. There's a challenge there for Buddhism in Australia to perhaps have a higher profile when people are thinking of public policy, etc. So that's just a little diversion that I've taken, but I'm going back to my first issue, to care. What do we mean by to care? Wonderful. Now, when I thought about this, my first thought was the West Coast Eagles. Remember Mick Malthouse? The great days. I've been to football heaven. 2006, they lost to Sydney by 1 point. 2007, they won by 1 point. I'm happy. Totally happy about football. I don't need to go, the Eagles are doing well, I'm happy to see it. Very happy. That was heaven. And Mick Malthouse said this thing, the 1%. Do you remember the 1%ers? It's quite a good expression. He said the 1%ers are when someone heads off and he's got the ball and you're way behind and you give it away. He said the really good one, they'll chase, because you never know. The guy might fall over and drop the ball and then you can pick it up. But if you haven't done the 1%, so that's my football reference for you for this evening, the 1%ers. I would like to talk about to care. I think there are three dimensions that are interesting to me. The first one is caring for yourself. The second one, of course, is caring for the others, individually or collectively. I think we have a responsibility to our society as a whole, as well as to any individual we meet and that we have an obligation to support, and caring for the environment in which we live. Let's start with caring for yourself. My friend Lackey had a great quote he used to use, and I love this quote. He say, it's a Buddhist saying, it says, it's not possible for one who is stuck in the mud to help out another. But it is possible for one who is not stuck in the mud to help another who is stuck in the mud. It is not possible that a man who has not saved himself to save another. Looking after yourself is very important. It's very important. Caring for yourself is very important. It doesn't mean you become self-interested in the narrow, egotistical sense of that, but it does mean that you should care for yourself. There's lots of aspects to this. I'm interested in a fairly simple version of self-awareness. Obviously, there are very different levels, and the whole mindfulness discussion takes us into that space. But I think we can think about ourselves at a pretty basic but important level. What are our capacities? What are our likes and dislikes? The great management guru, Peter Drucker, some of you might have come across his work, he's a wonderful writer. He's passed away now. You know his last work, he said, what's the answer to all of the work I've done on, and he said, managing yourself. The world we live in, so much rapid change. Managing yourself, that's the issue. And he has a lovely essay where he talks about how we can learn from what we do. For example, Let's say you're in a management position and you have to appoint people. You appoint Mr. X or Miss X or Mrs. X, and you write down why you appointed them, and then sometime later you look at how they performed. Did they perform in the way that you thought they would? Or did the decision you make turn out the way? And if it didn't, ask yourself, well, why didn't it? Perhaps it was because I didn't really understand my own personality and character, the biases that I had. So this is not that difficult, but it's just a little thing that you can do, and I find using that, what he called the feedback analysis, is very good. You have to have integrity. If you want to look after yourself, integrity is very important. If you're in a world that is working in a way that you really can't cope, for example, you may be a quite a conservative type of person working for a high risk-taking entrepreneur, and you're just uncomfortable. You can't work in that sort of a way. You have to be true to yourself. And if you're not true to yourself, the consequences will flow in without any question or doubt. If you're uncomfortable, it will reflect. Again, back to my point, you can never escape consequences. And of course, compassion, interestingly, is better for you than the reverse or the opposite. Heartlessness is not good for your health. So I think this idea of caring for yourself is a very, very important part of the caring agenda. Think about yourself, your capacities, your deep likes and dislikes. Monitor your relationships and at work and your commitments. Are you in the right job? Have you got friends who you can talk to? Check on your conscience. How's your conscience going? This is important, I think, part of caring. If you don't care for yourself, it's very hard to care for other people. And there's also a simple fact of the life. If you care, and I hate to say this, but in a sense, if you care too much, and by that I mean you don't care about yourself, you might find you're ill, and you can't help other people if you're ill. You're stressed out. You can't cope. You're not really helping other people if you're in that situation. Now, it's interesting that I've said that I think part of caring for yourself is caring for others as well. Definitely, there's a lot of evidence now on this that if you're altruistic and you're committed to helping others and you're involved with helping others in all sorts of ways, there's a health spin-off. There's definitely a health spin-off. So what we're learning here, I think, is there's something about human beings that we can learn. You know, we work in societies, we have emotions, we have feelings, and if we work all of this carefully, we can get good. We can get some good in this world. It's not impossible to make a happier world. Now, what about caring for other people? Well, I think there's sort of two aspects to this. One aspect is the people that you're sort of close to or that you come across, and where perhaps the word compassion comes in. Compassion's a very tough word, by the way. It's a good one for a discussion. Compassion's not just about doing something that will be helpful, which is important. It means you're really into it. Your whole, your gut, your internal, you really feel. I lived in Fremantle for some time. We had a wonderful neighbour who was a lady from Italy, no education. She was in fact illiterate. But she had a beautiful garden out the back, you know, as a lot of Italian migrants did to Australia. And when when something happened in the world, like a flood or whatever, she just burst into tears. She just burst into tears about this terrible, and she found it very, she couldn't do anything about it, but she had enormous feeling. So I think compassion's important. Difficult. The parable of the Good Samaritan's a good one, coming from the Christian religion. Very challenging. Very challenging, but that's the sort of challenge that, you know, distinguishes the real humanity that we have. There's also our collective caring. I mean, we have to care for our society, and is it functioning well? Is everyone getting a fair go? I think it's important. And it's citizenship. It's all about citizenship. And I think I gave a talk earlier today at Curtin University on you know, what does it mean to have a good society and how do we contribute to it? And it was on the French Revolution. The slogan, the motto, liberty, equality and fraternity. I've just spent some time in France. Retirement, everyone, it's fantastic. it's pretty good. I've done a course at the University of Amsterdam. I've done a portrait drawing course. I'm going off to Mexico to take in some history of the Crusades at a little town where they have these summer school courses. It's very interesting. But the French had this thing, liberty, equality, fraternity. Now, put the fraternity to one side for a second. Liberty and equality. If you get a good mix of freedom and equality, you've got a good society. And you have to fight for it. You have to make sure that somehow or another the message is out there that if we get these two together, we can get very good outcomes. You have total freedom, you'll get a bit of anarchy, and you might get a huge amount of inequality. Too much inequality, you might have too much state power over the individual. In there somewhere, there's a nice mix of those things. The middle way. You know, in politics, they think the middle way is a political term. We all know that the middle way is a Buddhist term. So caring for others, very important. In all of your dealings, you know, are you making the situation better than it was before? Are you going through the motions, or are you actually actively encouraging a worse result than before? Phew, have we had some politics in Canberra in the last week? So, caring for yourself, caring for the other person, both individually in your day-to-day work, but also collectively in your society and the community that you live in. And then finally, there's the caring for the environment. This is very important. It's the foundation upon which life is built. It has a major impact on amenity and health. And of course, nature. I'm interested, by the way, in the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, you know, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. By the way, very, very impressive poem, very, very difficult poem. Why did the man shoot the albatross? He just did it. He could, therefore he did it. This worry that there's evil in the world, you know, and you can't necessarily find a cause for it. He went from believing in causes and effects to believing that there was original sin. Very interesting intellectual movement. But anyway, we won't talk about that today. But he was fascinated by nature. He wrote beautifully. He used to go walking, climbing. And of course, he became an opium addict, which had certain discomfort attached to it because he, in the early 19th century, by the way, it was a painkiller at that time. There was nothing, no illegality about it all. But the way he talks about nature and what we can learn from it and how we can feel it, he loved animals. Some wonderful poems on animals, how we should respect and care for animals. And we need a bit of awe and wonder. You know the story, of course, about one of those great American films, Charlton Heston, you know, the ones all about the Bible, all those films they had. The director went to Charlton Heston and said, Charlton, this was the scene where Jesus is carrying the cross and, you know, the Romans are carrying him up there and he's subject to abuse and everything. And the director says to Charlton, you know, this is one of the most important pieces of history for our culture. Put a bit of awe into it. And so then they do the next shot, and the shot goes on to Charlton Heston. He says, "Oh, there goes a man." Well, so The awe and the wonder I think I'm talking about is just that, you know, what you get from nature, that you need access to it. You need access to it, and you know it can deliver for health, but also its basic integrity is important. So caring for the environment is very, very important. And so we're left with yourself, the other, and the environment. And we can still work out, you know, are we contributing in a positive way to all of these sorts of things? But the one that I've increasingly find myself interested in is to care about the speech that you use, the words you use, and how you use them. And I used to try and get this across to my colleagues, how important this is, because I used to be very active when in my time in politics in visiting, you know, multicultural Western Australia, all the different communities, and you know, I'd get feedback on what's going on. And quite often I'd get the response from some people say, well, look, we love living in Australia and it's fantastic, but my son or daughter came home from school crying and she was at the bus stop and a car pulled up, put down the window and you know, abused that person because of their racial background, or they might be a Sikh, or they might be a Muslim, and they abused them. And the kids come home and, you know, a lot of people, they just don't think how words really matter. Words really matter. And I'm afraid my use of that idea when I was in politics had a sort of a utilitarian bent, that I remember reading that when judges have to determine matters, they look at the second reading speech in the parliament. What did the politicians want to do when they passed this law? And I said to all my colleagues, you've got to do good second reading speeches, because a lot of them weren't very good at all. They didn't take any care over the second reading speech. So I've always understood that words matter when it comes to legislation and judicial interpretation. I've understood that. But as a result of mixing with a lot of communities throughout Western Australia, you know, how words can really kill. They can really damage. And yet we have this cavalier attitude that we should just be able to speak as we wish without any thinking of the consequences. We should speak to encourage harmony rather than disharmony. We should speak to settle things down when there's too much heat and the heat's people getting out of control, they're losing control over themselves. So I think right speech is something that is very important, to abstain from telling lies or deceiving people. Again, it's all contextual. There's always the story of the Gestapo knocking on the door when the Dutch or the Belgian or the French family are protecting a Jewish person in the Second War, and they say, have you got so-and-so here? And you say, no, they shot through 3 weeks ago. I think we can accept that. But deceiving people as a matter of policy, if you like, not good. We shouldn't slander others and speak so as to create disharmony. These things work, by the way. They work. You know, it sounds as though when people say something like this, you know, they're sitting up there on the pedestal, you know, lecturing to people. But I've found so often in the real tough old world of politics that I was involved in, and we're meeting people and we have conflicts, sometimes just, you can get it down. We had our meditation earlier. You can get it down and people then start to think objectively. And right speech can be very powerful in solving conflict as well as avoiding conflict. It can be powerful in abstain from rude and impolite speech or abusive speech. Do not indulge in idle chatter. That's difficult for gossip. I remember there was someone who wrote a thesis in politics on the role of rumour in politics. And you watched all the events in the last week. Was journalists said, well, someone told me that he did this. Then that person said, well, we didn't do that. Sometimes people actually throw a story out there, knowing it to be untrue, but to just get it out there because it serves some function. And so I think right speech is very, very important. And there's a tendency that's cropped up in recent years that all opinions are facts. We don't really have to think about what we say. We have the right to say what we like. And this is creating tension in society. This is encouraging conflict. And I think a wonderful contribution. I was asked actually on ABC Breakfast. Did anyone hear me on ABC Breakfast this week? God, gee whiz. I don't know. My rating's obviously gone down since I've been away. But they asked me about democracy, and I thought, well, what a good chance. So I threw in the argument about right speech and how important it is. I remember one of my colleagues who was losing his temper and really losing it, and he was starting to abuse people, and I said very gently to him, you know, that biblical injunction to turn the other cheek? I said, you know, that's a very interesting bit of ethics and morality. He said, but sometimes I find that it's actually very good for solving a political problem. And this character, who shall remain nameless, but he was a former leader of the Labor Party, he was a very tough, hard-hitting character. He looked at me and he didn't see any of it. And so I think getting above yourself a little bit so you can see that you can contribute to solutions without having a fight necessarily, because the fight means the strongest win. I mean, that's what happens then, or the smartest. You don't necessarily get the proper outcome. So I think right speech is something that's very, very important to me. But look, I've said quite a few things, and I'd like to sort of bring it to an end now. I believe that Buddhism should make a bigger contribution, and it's not easy. Arjun Brahm was telling me, you know, that trying to get a Guernsey for the Buddhists on the Q&A program, and you know, been unable to do that. And we get some pretty desperate types on that program from time to time. And you know, I really think it needs to be more up there. It needs to be up there because there's so much to contribute. Just those comments I made. You know, there's the Eightfold Path, but the part on speech particularly interests me. By the way, good speech requires good listening. We had an education session once of my party colleagues, and one of my colleagues knew someone who was an expert on listening. And the listening expert came. You're talking about politicians, right? There's one thing they should be able to do is listen. And the listening expert did all these programs with us. No listening was happening at all. It was going in here and out here. And there was no impact. They weren't listening. The whole point of listening is to listen and to find out what comes out of it. And so these are aspects of mainstream Buddhism, right speech, listening. This is at the heart of it. And yet we don't know enough about it as a community, and that's why I think that's important. But I guess I'd like to finish with this, back to this simple idea of living with difference, which I find the biggest challenge of all in our society. Living with difference, a very big challenge. And I had a wonderful ride in a car here today, Uber driver, who was a wonderful guy who was from Ethiopia. First thing I will comment, I was amazed, I said, how big's your family? And he said, I've got 20 brothers and sisters. He said, never have to worry. He said, we don't worry. We don't. And he takes his hands off the wheel. I said, well, you drive the car. And we don't worry. They'll all come and help us if we're in trouble, you know, 20. The one great thing about living in Sydney is the taxi drivers. They're unbelievable. You engage them on all sorts of subjects. Living with difference. The best advice I can give, and I'll conclude with this, comes from the Mahatma. Whatever words we utter, this is on the speech, whatever words we utter should be chosen with care, for this is from the Buddha, in fact, for people will hear them and be influenced by them. So that's back to, but Mahatma said, we all live in a house and we've got to open up all the windows, open up all the doors, and take in everything. Take it in, let it flow through. Pick it up, listen. So he's got this wonderful idea. We all have our own tradition, and that's our home. But there are all sorts of other traditions, and we should learn from them. Open up the windows, let it come through. That's why I'm a passionate believer in the multicultural ideal. Australia is so much better now as a result of migration. The understanding that people bring from other countries is now part of our thinking. If they didn't come, we wouldn't have been thinking about certain things. And so Mahatma's view is that we take it all in, we learn from other people, and as I said, my experience has been that when I read Buddhist literature and the wonderful stories that Ajahn Brahm has put together, I see insight there all the time, always insight that can contribute positively to our society. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you tonight. There was a Neo-Confucian who once said in China said that, you know, if you don't like what I'm saying, if you like what I'm saying, I'll be very contented. And he said, if you don't like what I'm saying, I'll be even more contented. Now, how's that? I mean, that's the Eastern tradition. When they set up at the university Western civilization, they've got to have the East in there as well. Thank you very much. Thank you. Absolutely. Just incidentally, when I was studying philosophy at Oxford, there was an exam question. And the exam question was, is this a question? I don't know, but there was a student. I reckon he must have been Ajahn Brahm's relative. Because his answer was, well, if it is, this is an answer. So. Yep. This.
Climate science is probably the ones that get the least respect for the world. And how opinions are now, as you said, I thought it was interesting, that opinions are now becoming facts.
That's right.
Which reminds us of that phrase, alternative facts.
It does, yeah.
I just wonder if you'd like to...
Look, I'm now writing on this subject. I gave a lecture on it last week, actually, on this post-truth phenomenon. I went to a talk only 2 weeks ago from Professor Larry Gostin. Professor Larry Gostin is the Professor of Public Health Law at Georgetown University, a very distinguished academic who was the person that organised the American assistance for the Ebola crisis in the Obama administration. He's a public health lawyer right up there. And he gave a talk on all of these subjects about science and public health, and he said, look, it's so bad. It's so bad now that people have these attitudes, and we have to fight every step of the way in public health. And apparently there was a meeting in Atlanta, Georgia, of the Centers for Disease Control, which is a very important American bureaucracy, set up to promote public health. Now, they've got a new government in America. We've had it for a couple of years. We won't mention who the president is, but we know who it is. And they're not allowed to look at gun control. That is not a public health issue. So that's point one. So they had a meeting, and the White House sent down their budget people and said, when you put in submissions, there are seven words you shouldn't use. Number one, vulnerable. Number two, entitlement. Number three, diversity. Number four, fetus, which is an interesting one. I can't quite see, but I can see that's, you know, obviously there's issues related to abortion there. Transgender, no. Science-based policy, no. Evidence-based policy, no. And Larry, Professor Larry Gostin, a very distinct, he said, look, I mean, there's only one thing for us to do. We've got to stand up for science. And a lot of the American scientists are standing up because, you know, as we know, science can make an amazing contribution to well-being in all sorts of areas. But who would have thought that a government body would say to people, don't talk about evidence-based policy? I mean, that is quite scary. And I think the post-truth phenomenon is a reflection of an angry society, and we've got to deal with the causes as well as the consequences. And I don't think we deal with the angry society by feeding it. If we feed the monster gets bigger. I think we have to try and win people back from these, I think, quite outrageous and dangerous views that are coming on, coming forward. Because I just want you to imagine something. Imagine a world where there are no points of reference. I mean, we've got a point of reference to a lot of our thinking, the way we plan our cities, the way we've organised waste management, the way we get into a plane and go up into the sky, the way we organise our health system, not perfectly, but with all the modern science in there to help people when they're injured, etc. It's a huge underpinning to our existence, informed by research, peer-based, etc. And it's a complete underpinning. There's still debate. It's not perfect. We all know there's still debate about truth and contestability. But take that out. Just imagine this. Take that out. Imagine our society without that bedrock of evidence. You know, the only way you can resolve a difference in that society is through force or manipulation. You either con people and persuade them and manipulate them, or you threaten them and take power. That is the only solution. It is a bad world. It's a very bad world, and it would have dire consequences. And so we have to fight for science. Thank you.
Yeah. I remember very well because our son was he won the UK with the Multicultural Youth Ambassador Award.
Oh, fantastic. Yep.
Yep. And all road forest, all that. I think my question is when you said Peter Brachter that triggered something, managing for results is good. I think how did you manage? I remember when I was going from City of Rockingham, you came to the, you had a cabinet meeting. I shared the breakfast table with probably three or four ministers that day, probably 2002
yep.
or 2003. I think all the ministers must be thinking, one day I can become the premier. That's the politicians.
Yep.
So how did you manage such a diverse and very, what shall I say, very anxious and very such a group of people for the betterment of this state?
Yeah.
How did you manage?
Well, I look, teamwork is very important. And, you know, when you see effective government, what you often don't see, you'll see the politician who'll give the speech, but you don't necessarily see the work that goes on behind the scenes by the public service on the one hand and by the advisers, chief of staff, etc. So I would say that, you know, I would never say that my success, in as much as I had some from on some issues, etc., was my doing. I hope I contributed positively to that. But teamwork's very important, you know, cooperating to achieve an objective. And I was blessed with some wonderful staff who worked for me and helped me out on that. But it's very difficult in politics to bring the long term in. Funnily enough, you know, in Buddhism we say we've got to focus on the now. And I understand, I think, what that's saying. I mean, the future hasn't happened yet and the past is gone, And so that, but in a funny sort of a way, we've got to, I worry about my grandchildren, you know, what the world we create. So in that sense, we have to be considered. But gee, how do you, the long term, bringing the long term in, vested interest, self-interest, it's very, very difficult to do that. But I'm increasingly of the view that we need to involve people in a different way. Citizen juries, where we randomly select people for little issues, citizens' assemblies, where we bring people in and allow them to deliberate on a problem. We've got to break down this distrust between government, because we're not solving our problems. I mean, take, fancy having Australia, such a wealthy nation, we haven't dealt with climate. I mean, we knew about it, and I feel somewhat guilty in relation to this too, but we were moving towards it. We've had about six different attempts to bring the energy system. We've failed on each one of them. You know, we're not dealing with the big issues. And the reason for that is, I think, that the vested interests are too powerful. And we've got to try and find a way to convince the vested interests that it's also in their better interest to have a better society. So I think, answer to your question, teamwork on the one side, but a lot of hard work to bring people in, to try to convince them, to work with them, not ignore them, and to build a consensus. And it's not easy. Well, you know, just a little thing. I remember I had a wonderful, remember the tsunami.
Yes,
and I said, well, we should, this is a terrible thing. And I said to all of the religions, I said, all come together and tell the government how you think we should show our sympathy. And they did. And as you know, we went down to City Beach. It was a wonderful. And they all got together. You know, they're all there together coming up with a solution. And so the other thing, I was very, you know, I hope that I was, I really, I, racism's a terrible thing. And you know, and that's a spiritual thing. You know, racism is the antithesis of spirituality in a way, you know, where you're just totally just disrespecting someone. And we had a task force set up, and we did a lot of work on that. We built in a strategy for our public servants to try and get equal outcomes for the people. So I think on that one, and you know, I love going to all the different religious denominations and listening to what they say and trying to build it into. But my big one was the Buddhist thing, because I'd say to the cabinet, give me a solution. Go the Buddhist way to solve a problem. Get a solution. And I think that was probably an important part there.
I studied philosophy at uni. I was studying
philosophy. Yeah.
And I guess I wanted to ask
you,
if I can ask
you
a question, but just
quickly
after.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean? Like, so yeah, after the
speech. Yeah, no, I'll be around. Yep.
So, yeah,
yep.
So it won't take that much.
Yeah, sure, yep. Is any at the back?
Yeah, I think I find one of the biggest, for some time now, I try to practice Buddhism, but I think one of the biggest challenges I have is how we deal with volatile situations, you know, how Buddhism believes in a more passive way, more compassion, more right speech, right door. But would you deal with that very, you know, when you have in the workplace or in business,
look, I just think, one, I believe this very strongly, that, you know, acting with the right intention, the right, it does produce results, but it's a bit scary. Have you been to the Anti-Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg? It's got two sections. It's got one section on apartheid and how it worked, and the other section's on Mandela. I mean, this man, he was very, very insightful. And imagine this. He's in prison. The white South African regime is his enemy. He could see things were changing, and he wanted to win them over. He had people in his own party who wanted to go to war because they had the majority. You know, they had, and you know, they had a right to try and bring down the regime, which was a terrible regime. But of course, if that was the strategy, it would have led to a huge amount of bloodshed. But his young people are saying, we've got to fight, get rid of the white fellas, they're no good. You know, they've created pain. And then on the other side, he's got extremists on the right-wing side. Remember the man on the horse, you might remember, with the extreme, and they were shooting and killing some of the young black activists. And Mandela said, no, there's a different way here. There's a different way here. He won the confidence of the white, de Klerk, who played a very important role, by the way, but he won him over. And he also made contact with all of the enemies. When he became president, to keep the sense of consultation and reconciliation, had a tea party for all of the former presidents and their wives. And the wife of the founder of apartheid wouldn't come. She was still alive. He went to her house to have a tea with her. And it worked. I mean, you know, South Africa's not perfect and there are issues there now, etc. It worked. He managed it. Now, he could have said it's just all too hard, we can't do it, you know, but he stuck at it. And I think if I could do something to every young person to go, because this museum has quotes, speeches, and it shows it all, how he managed this transition out of apartheid with a minimum loss of life. In fact, there was none particularly associated with that. There was in the general context, because he believed that reconciliation was a force within the human condition. It had other forces working against it, but it was there. And so I say, there's evidence, to use the evidence-based thing, there's evidence that these things can work. Now, I tell you, and I've been there where I've not taken any of that advice, and, you know, in those of you in management positions, whatever, sometimes we all lose our temper sometimes and we get out of control and we do stupid things. But reflecting upon it, you can work out there was another way and we didn't take it and we've got the consequences of not taking it. So I do think there's evidence for Buddhism. There's a lot of evidence. This is not just, you know, a belief. This is a belief with a backup.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure that you will agree with me that tonight has been a wonderful occasion, a wonderful event. And I'm just sort of reminded towards the end there too when you're talking about Buddhism in South Africa and some of the wonderful things that came out of that Peace and Reconciliation Conference. But I also think of our Buddhist Dalai Lama and Archbishop Tutu and their wonderful friendship that they've got going together. I know my wife's got a book on the dialogue between them on her bedside right at the moment. But Jeff, it's been a wonderful night, and I would like to invite you all to show your appreciation for Jeff Gallop.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you.